I'd like you to turn in your Bible then to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. If you open the Bible in the middle of the Psalms and then go on, Psalms, Proverbs, and then we come to Ecclesiastes. In the middle of the Bible there are five books which the Jews used to call the writings or the poetic books. And in our series, one book at a time, when we are looking in a kind of survey way, in an introductory way, at each book in the Bible, we are at the moment looking at these poetry books. We've considered the book of Job, the book of Psalms, the book of Proverbs, and now we come to one of the strangest books in the whole of the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes. There is another name for these books around here, and that is wisdom literature. And the book of Ecclesiastes contains a good deal of the so-called wisdom of the world, but it's in conflict with the true wisdom of God, as we're going to see. The word Ecclesiastes is the Greek word for preacher, and it comes from the first verse of the book, the words of the preacher. In the Hebrew, it's Koheleth, spelt with a Q in English letters and without a U, I noticed in my Bible. Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. Koheleth. And it means speaker or preacher. I thought of it because when we were on holiday, we played a word game called Lexicon. And I always seem to get the Q. And you can't do anything with it unless you have a U. But I didn't know this word. And anyway, you're not allowed to have Hebrew words. But evidently Hebrew words have Q words without U's. Koheleth, and it means the preacher or the speaker. Now this is a very difficult book. I was consulting the New Bible Commentary Revised. And the commentary on Ecclesiastes is by Dr. George S. Hendry, M.A.D.D., Professor of Systematic Theology at Princeton Theological Seminary, New Jersey. And he says that the book is disjointed, it has obscure vocabulary, it's enigmatic, it baffles understanding, it has words which are found nowhere else in the Old Testament, and therefore whose meaning is hard to determine. It's difficult to ascertain the author's own view at times, and there seems to be no connected sequence of thought running through it. He says it defies logical analysis, and that's why in his commentary he doesn't give any outline of the contents presented. And so if he couldn't, I certainly can't. And that's why the board isn't up tonight with an outline on, because you can't have one. It defies it, this particular book. Yet, Professor Hendry says, this book nevertheless has a powerful fascination. And it contains penetrating observation and criticism of the human scene. Some of the favourite phrases in the book are phrases like, things are vanity. You'll notice verse 2 is that. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. And that means futility, uselessness, meaninglessness, pointlessness, emptiness. Everything's empty. Everything's pointless. Very cynical view. And another favourite phrase, and it's a very important one actually, in interpreting this difficult book, is the phrase, under the sun. 28 times you have it in Ecclesiastes, under the sun. It's a viewpoint taken from a human point of view, under the sun. When you become a Christian, there's a sense in which your viewpoint becomes over the sun. You're in the heavenlies, you have a heavenly viewpoint. But this contains much which is under the sun. Another favourite phrase is chasing the wind. Chasing the wind, a useless exercise. It seems in places to be extremely cynical, and it's out of keeping with the teaching of the rest of the Bible. And that's why we need to know how to interpret it. Sometimes I am asked by people, do you believe every statement in the Bible to be true? And I answer by saying, I believe every word of the Bible as originally given to have been inspired by God. But I don't believe that every statement which occurs in the Bible is true, because some of the things that occur in the Bible come from the devil. There are things in the Bible that the devil said. He's the father of lies. And many of the things that Job's so-called comforters said are not true. And there are many things in the book of Ecclesiastes which are not, in fact, true. So this is not a record of God's arguments, it's God's record of man's arguments in many of its places. And that's very important if you're going to understand it. Now, to give you an idea of how difficult it is and how out of keeping with the godly teaching of the Bible, I'm just going to read you two chapters from the Good News Bible. And I want you to listen to them, this translation, so that you can really get the flavour of it. First two chapters, these are the words of the philosopher. That's how they translate this word, Ecclesiastes, the preacher. David's son, who was king in Jerusalem, this is what he says. It is useless, useless, said the philosopher. Life is useless, all useless. You spend your life working, labouring, and what do you have to show for it? Generations come and generations go, but the world stays just the same. The sun still rises and it still goes down, going wearily back to where it must start all over again. The wind blows south and the wind blows north, round and round and back again. Every river flows into the sea, but the sea's not yet full. The water returns to where the rivers began and starts all over again. Everything leads to weariness, a weariness too great for words. Our eyes can never see enough to be satisfied. Our ears can never hear enough. What has happened before will happen again. What has been done before will be done again. There is nothing new in all the world. Look, they say, here is something new. But no, it has all happened before, long before we were born. No one remembers what has happened in the past, and no one in days to come will remember what happens between now and then. I, the philosopher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. I determined that I would examine and study all things that are done in this world. God has laid a miserable fate upon us. I've seen everything done in this world, and I tell you, it's all useless. It's like chasing the wind. You can't straighten out what is crooked. You can't count things that aren't there. I told myself, I have become a great man, far wiser than anyone who ruled Jerusalem before me. I know what wisdom and knowledge really are. I was determined to learn the difference between knowledge and foolishness, wisdom and madness, but I found out that I might as well be chasing the wind. The wiser you are, the more worries you have. And the more you know, the more it hurts. I decided to enjoy myself and find out what happiness is. But I found that this is useless too. I discovered that laughter is foolish, that pleasure does you no good. Driven on by my desire for wisdom, I decided to cheer myself up with wine and have a good time. I thought that this might be the best way people can spend their short lives on earth. I accomplished great things. I built myself houses and planted vineyards. I planted gardens and orchards with all kinds of fruit trees in them. I dug ponds to irrigate them. I bought many slaves, and there were slaves born in my household. I owned more livestock than anyone else who had ever lived in Jerusalem. I also piled up silver and gold from the royal treasuries of the lands I ruled. Men and women sang to entertain me. I could have had all the women a man could want. Yes, I was great, greater than anyone else who had ever lived in Jerusalem, and my wisdom never failed me. Anything I wanted, I got. I did not deny myself any pleasure. I was proud of everything I had worked for, and all this was my reward. Then I thought about all that I had done and how hard I had worked doing it, and I realized that it didn't mean a thing. It was like chasing the wind, of no use at all. After all, a king can only do what previous kings have done. So I started thinking about what it meant to be wise or reckless or foolish. Oh, I know, wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. Wise men can see where they are going and fools cannot. But I also know that the same fate is waiting for us all. I thought to myself, I will suffer the same fate as fools, so what have I gained from being wise? Nothing. I answered, not a thing. No one remembers wise men and no one remembers fools. In days to come we will all be forgotten. We must all die, wise and foolish alike. So life came to mean nothing to me because everything in it had brought me nothing but trouble. It had all been useless. I had been chasing the wind. Nothing that I had worked for and earned meant a thing to me because I knew that I would have to leave it to my successor. And he might be wise or he might be foolish, who knows? Yet he will own everything I have worked for, everything my wisdom has earned for me in this world. It's all useless. So I came to regret that I had worked so hard. You work for something with all your wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then you have to leave it all to someone who hasn't had to work for it. It is useless, and it isn't right. You work and worry your way through life, and what do you have to show for it? As long as you live, everything you do brings nothing but worry and heartache. Even at night your mind can't rest. It is all useless. The best thing a man can do is eat and drink and enjoy what he has earned. And yet I realize that even this comes from God. How else could you have anything to eat or enjoy yourself at all? God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness to those who please him, but he makes sinners work, earning and saving, so that what they get can be given to those who please him. It is all useless. It is like chasing the wind. Now, I read that from a modern translation because I want to bring home to you those first two chapters, which in a way are a kind of flavour of the whole book. If you want to try to understand Ecclesiastes, think of it like this. The word Ecclesiastes, as I've said, are the words of the speaker. Now, there is a place in London called Speaker's Corner. It's near Marble Arch in Hyde Park. I often, when I was a student in London, used to go there on a Sunday afternoon. And you will find there little knots of people, sometimes bigger crowds of people, listening to somebody on a soapbox or some kind of stand. And he will be spouting forth. And sometimes people will be shouting things back, heckling or arguing with him. And you may move from one to the other and listen to what they have to say. And they all have their different answers to the problems of the world. Is there any point in living? They are trying to answer that question. What does the world need? What is the real meaning for life? What is it all about? And they're each bringing what they consider to be their answer, their wisdom. And somebody who disagrees or who thinks it's a load of old rubbish will say so, and often why. Occasionally you may find a man who believes in God who is saying something. Occasionally you may find a person who is a real Christian and whose mind has been enlightened by the word, who is preaching the truth. Now I want you to imagine that the writer of Ecclesiastes, who probably was King Solomon, doesn't actually say so, but does say that he was a son of David and a king in Jerusalem, and that he had a lot of wisdom, and that he had a lot of wives, and he had a lot of money, and he did everything, and it sounds like Solomon. I want you to imagine that he, in fact, had been round the local speaker's corner. And he'd had a notepad, and he'd listened to what all were saying, and he jotted down what they were saying, absolutely verbatim, and also what he thought of it. And then he put it all together, without really any kind of thread or any clues as to what was his own view and what was their view. And he interspersed it with some proverbs, and he interspersed it with some things that were absolutely true about God, and he piled it all together and he put it into the book of the Bible, and it's called Ecclesiastes. And so that's why it's so difficult to sort out, because it's a collection of the so-called wisdom of man, with all his different ideas as to the meaning of life and the purpose of life, and this man's views upon it. You see, some people say that life is really progress. It's the theory of evolution turned into a philosophy, and that's very current today. That the real meaning of life is really that we're doing something to push history forward another step, and that really history is progression. Every age gets a little bit better than the last one. And so that's the meaning of life, to help this enterprise forward a little bit more over millions of years. And in chapter 1, Ecclesiastes says, what a load of rubbish. There is no progress at all. It's all useless. It's all vanity. Think about it, he says to the evolutionist, whatever he calls himself. He says, it goes round in cycles. It's not progressive. Look around you, he says, at things under the sun. And you'll see that they're cyclic. They go around in cycles. Even nature does. The sun rises and the sun goes down. And it comes up again, goes down again, comes up again, goes down again. And the water flows down into the sea, but the sea doesn't get any fuller. There's a system whereby it goes up into the air and precipitates down again. And history is like that. There's nothing new. You think that there's something new. Somebody says, ah, this is new. It isn't really. It's all been done before. It's all been done before of the things that really matter. That's his conclusion about that. And when you begin to think like that, well, then you begin to say, as somebody had evidently done, and he's referring to this in chapter 2, oh, I'm going to live for the moment. I'm going to live for pleasure. I'm not interested in leaving footprints in the sand for some other generation to see. I want something for me, here and now. So I'm going to indulge myself in pleasure. And that is the meaning of life. Hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure. Ah, but says Ecclesiastes, that's useless as well, because it doesn't satisfy. I've tried all that. I had piles of money. I was a king, a great king. I could have anything I wanted, and I had it all. And I found that it didn't satisfy me. Ah, but says another person at Speaker's Corner, that hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, is not the real meaning of life. You're not an animal, you're a creature, you've got something special, you're meant to be creative. You're not just a creature, you're more than that, you're a human being. You've got to make things and work and find fulfillment in that. Yes, says Ecclesiastes, I tried all that as well. I built great palaces and great houses and I irrigated them, beautiful gardens and everything, and I found a certain amount of fulfillment. But then when I began to think about it, I thought, who's going to get this lot when I'm gone? Somebody who didn't work for it. He might be an absolute fool. Why do I have to leave it all behind? And so there he is heckling the speaker at Speaker's Corner, and he says, all right, so your man builds up a great business and he works 18 hours a day, and he gets grey early in life to worrying about the accounts and the profits and all that, profit and loss. What does it all add up to for him in the end? Nothing but worry and heartache. And he leaves it all behind, perhaps to an absolute fool. There's no real meaning to life. It's vanity, it's uselessness, it's stupid. There is no real meaning to life. Nobody's going to remember you anyway. Even the great people of the world, even we kings, are soon forgotten. They fly forgotten as a dream flies at the opening day. Do you know, when I was on holiday, I was reading a very sad book. It was about the last days of the presidency of Mr. Nixon. And one of the things he kept asking people, he kept asking his aides, were, how do you think history will treat me? My contemporaries are giving me a bad time. They think very bad of me. All the papers are against me. Everyone seems to be turning against me. But he said, with the perspective of history, when people begin to think not only of the bad things they think I've done, but the good things that I have done, how do you think history will treat me? And there are some people who are in these important places who have nothing really to fulfill them in this life, and so they have to fasten on what will be said about them in the history books. And Ecclesiastes says, not much. Not much. They fly forgotten as a dream flies at the opening day. And all that's in those early chapters, and it goes on right through the book. Materialism, hedonism, evolutionism, or creationism, or whatever else you like to say. The pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of possessions, the pursuit of building up things. It's all useless. And you may as well come to that conclusion, he says. In chapter 3, he perhaps answers the fatalist. I don't know. Some people think that this famous section about different times is a survey of the providence of God. Other people think it's something quite different. You'll leave it to yourself. Verse 16 of chapter 3 observes that all over the world there's wickedness where there ought to be justice and righteousness. Chapter 3, verse 16. And then we get this flash in verse 17. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for he has appointed a time for every matter and for every work. That's true, isn't it? But then he says to the person who's saying, ah, I don't believe in God, but everything will right itself in the end. He says, how do you know? How do you know what happens after death? Verse 20, all go to one place, all are from the dust, all turn to dust again. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? How do you people at Speaker's Corner know that man has a soul and is going to God? What, you look around and he dies like a dog dies, and you bury him in the ground and that's the end of him for all you know. How do you know that things are going to be righted in the next life? Chapter 4, he refers to all the oppression that's practiced under the sun. And it doesn't matter who's in power. The Marxists say, ah, you see, it's these horrible capitalists and kings and people. If only the ordinary people could get power, then all would be good and right, and justice would be done in the world. Anticipating that, the Ecclesiastes says, not a bit of it. Sin is universal and oppression is universal. And it doesn't matter who has power, you'll find that there's oppression under the sun and people are oppressed. And there's nobody to deliver them and to comfort them. Do you know, friends, I don't know if you do know, but when Russia invaded Czechoslovakia, at long last, many British Marxists and communists saw the light on that particular thing and resigned from the Communist Party. Because at long last they realised that just as there had perhaps been oppression from the Tsar, as they believed in the previous regime, there was even more oppression now. They even have to build a wall around the people whom they have liberated by their Marxism and Leninism to keep them in, so that they enjoy, quote marks, their freedom. And shoot anybody who tries to escape from their liberty. And that's why, you see, the philosopher, the preacher, who's listening to the Marxist and Leninist or the equivalent in his own day says, oh no, useless. You're forgetting the evil in the heart of man. It's all vanity. There's no answer there. Riches don't satisfy. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so he goes on with all this. And we must hurry on. He turns his attention in chapter 5 to religion. All man is by nature religious, of course. He will worship some kind of God. Guard your steps, chapter 5, verse 1, when you go to the house of God. Think about your religion. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Kenneth Taylor, in his paraphrase of this, the Living Bible, I think he has something like this. When you go to worship, shut your mouth and open your ears. He's very vivid in his paraphrase because the preacher is very vivid in the things he says. He says that when people go to their religion and they go to worship God, they often have an awful lot to say and they make a lot of empty vows, but there's not much obedience and there's not much listening. And then verse 7 of chapter 5, there's not much fear of God. Do you fear God? Do you practice what you say you believe in your religion? Verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with gain. This is also emptiness. And he goes on with that theme for the next few verses. Does this mean then that a person should just become an ascetic and not enjoy the things of life? No. Verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and to be fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life which God has given him, for this is his lot. But then he goes on to say that the enjoyment of those things is also a gift from God. And the person who works for them in and of themselves and tries to find the meaning of life in those things themselves and doesn't come to God for the enjoyment of them will find that they are vanity. That's in chapter 6. They're just emptiness. They don't satisfy. In chapter 7 there are lots of different proverbs. I'd love to have time to focus on them all. But verse 14, chapter 7, in the day of prosperity be joyful, and in the day of adversity consider God has made the one as well as the other. Just remember that. Verse 10, by the way, of chapter 7 is a proverb. Say not, why were the former days better than these? Which means, in modern English, stop longing for the good old days. How do you know that they were any better than they are today? Go on to verse 28. He says, I have not found one man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. What on earth does that mean? Well, let me give you Kenneth Taylor's paraphrase of it. 0.1% of the men I interviewed could be said to be wise, but not one woman. I'll leave you to consider that. Chapter 7, verse 29. You may agree with the last verse if you don't agree with verse 28. Behold, this alone I found, that God has made man upright, but they have sought out many devices. And that's true to the Bible's teaching right the way through. In chapter 8, he's answering the anarchist who says, yes, it is, it's all useless, so therefore disobey the king, throw over the government, do what you like. No, he says, keep the king's command and do what he says. Anarchy is not the meaning of life either. Well, this mixture of human wisdom under the sun and Ecclesiastes' answer goes on through chapter 9 into chapter 10. I don't know whether you feel, in view of the impending general election in Britain, that chapter 10 and verse 2 comes from God or from the devil. A wise man's heart inclines him towards the right, but a fool's heart towards the left. Well, since in Ecclesiastes there are some things that are from God and some things that are merely man's wisdom and are foolish, I suppose each party can decide themselves which they think that is. Chapter 11, verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. In its context, that means you'd be wise to not put all your eggs into one basket, to make provision for yourself, because you never know, something might go completely wrong. Only God knows the future, and he's in control of all things. But of course, we apply it quite rightly to the spreading of the gospel and many other things. Toward the end of the book, he says two things to young people. One, verse 9 of chapter 11, rejoice, you young man in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Don't think about that when you're old. Think about it when you're young. Remember, verse 1 of chapter 12, also your Creator in the days of your youth. And then he goes on to picture, in very picturesque language, growing old. Verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. That's the hands. And the strong men are bent, that's the legs, and the grinders cease. I'll tell you Ecclesiastes one thing that you didn't know when you wrote your book, and that was that in 1978 you could go to the dentist and get some new grinders. And those that look through the windows are dimmed. That's the eyes, after the teeth. And the doors on the street are shut, verse 4, that's the ears. When the sound of the grinding is low, you can only gnash your gums now. And so he goes on to picture old age. He speaks of the silver cord being broken, verse 6, that holds your life. A silver cord, one day it will snap. And the pitcher broken, and the spirit body returns to the dust, and the spirit does return to God who gave it. But nevertheless, this is his conclusion by human wisdom, uselessness of uselessnesses, says the preacher. Everything is pointless. Have a look at verse 11. The sayings of the wise are like goads and like nails, firmly fixed are the collected sayings. There is one theory of interpreting the book of Ecclesiastes which fastens on that verse, because it's in the kind of postscript. And it says a goad is, of course, a shepherd's stick with a prong on the end that he poked the animals with, or a cattle dealer's. It's a stick, it's to provoke people. And those are the sayings that he puts that are not in keeping with the word of God, but which are, as things seem to be when you just look around you, to make you think. A goad is to goad you to think, not put your head in the sand. And like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings which are given by the one shepherd. The RSV puts it with a capital S because they think it refers to God. Tent pegs to anchor your house, which is your life. And so the book of Ecclesiastes contains goads which are to make you think and to look around and observe and consider the teachings of the world and the so-called philosophies of the world. But God's truth, which is contained in some places in Ecclesiastes and in other places in the Bible, and you see God has put Ecclesiastes in a book of 66 books that we might, in the light of the rest of the Bible, interpret this book correctly. They're like tent pegs. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Verse 13 of chapter 12, the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God. Here's a tent peg, and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So this is the conclusion then of studying this one book at a time. It's not all God's arguments. It's God's record of man's arguments. Ecclesiastes, the preacher, the speaker, is examining life from all angles and listening to all the voices who say what is the real purpose of life and where satisfaction can be found. All the different viewpoints are viewpoints under the sun, humanistic, meeting man on his own ground. But humanism and Marxism does not reckon with evil in the heart of man and with death. And evolutionism doesn't reckon with the cycle of history and of nature, and that there is no real progress because of the sin of man. God made man good and he's fallen. The book of Ecclesiastes is in many ways a commentary upon the curse of man and the fall, and upon Romans 8 verse 20, which speaks of the world being subjected to futility. Materialism and hedonism, the pursuit of possessions and pleasure, that's no good either because it doesn't satisfy. Creationism may be a bit better, and the pursuit of wisdom instead of folly may be a bit better, but what's the point of it anyway if you're going to die and leave it all behind? That's not the real answer. The wise and foolish both die. He says the only real philosophy, the only real human philosophy that seems to make any sense from man's point of view is nihilism. All is nothingness. And that is a very popular philosophy today, you know. Jean-Paul Sartre, there is no exit from the human dilemma. All is vanity. And Bertrand Russell, Nothing has any meaning, nothing has any point. It's all going to go up in one great gigantic holocaust. All is vanity. But you see, nihilism, which is a popular philosophy today, isn't new, you know. Because Shakespeare put it into the mouth of one of his characters, Macbeth, when his wife had committed suicide and Macduff was advancing with his armies, to say, "Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." So what Ecclesiastes says is absolutely right. There's nothing new. You modern philosophers and playwrights and so on, you think you're saying something new, that there's no meaning to life. Eat, drink and be merry. It's all been said before. It's all been said before. And so therefore, we have to come back to God and say the only person who can tell us if there is any meaning to life and why there are difficulties in life is God himself. And he will explain what he will explain, and what we can't understand, we have to trust him. Even though things are cyclic, even though wise men die young and fools live to an old age, even though there are many things in the world that we can't understand, we still trust him. And we remember our Creator in the days of our youth. Several years ago now, I was in the southern part of Spain in a big city, and I was taken to talk to a Spanish lady, a rich, very intelligent, very well-read Spanish lady, whose beautiful daughter had been converted to Christianity, to Christ, and whose other daughter was on the verge of it. But this woman was very cynical and bitter and hard. And the Spanish pastor had tried very much with her, and he wanted me to go and meet with her. We didn't waste our time with small talk. He wanted me to get right down to it. And as soon as we got there pretty well, through interpretation, I couldn't speak Spanish, he couldn't speak English, we began to talk about the things of God. And she began to quote me from the many modern authors that she'd read, and she was widely read, and she began to say, in her view, life was stupid and futile. I said, "The Bible says that." "What?" she said. "The Bible says that?" "Yes," I said, that statement's in the Bible." She said, "We've built up all this, we've got this beautiful home, but now we're growing old. What's the point of it all?" I said, "That's just what the Bible says." She said, "We've indulged ourselves with pleasure, but we don't get any satisfaction out of it. I think that the whole of the world is sick." I said, "That's exactly what the Bible says. You're in agreement with the Bible." She said, "Where's that in the Bible?" I said, "In the book of Ecclesiastes." And the Spanish pastor, his eyes were gleaming. You know, he couldn't wait to get the book of Ecclesiastes, and we turned it up. And to her astonishment, she found that God had put man's philosophy in his word for us to read long before she'd ever thought of it. And then I was able to show her from the same book and other books what the real answer to life is. I asked her if she would come and hear me preach at the Spanish church a day or two later on a Sunday, and she promised that she would. That evening, though I had to preach through interpretation, God, in his mercy and sovereignty, saved the soul of her second daughter. I wish I could tell you that that woman had trusted the Lord. As yet, I don't know if she has, but we can pray. So, every book has its place in the Bible. And many people have come in their cynicism and weariness to the book of Ecclesiastes, and they've looked at it like a mirror, and they've said, "That's exactly the conclusion I have come to." And they've started there in the book of Ecclesiastes, and then God has led them on to the gospel.